Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, October 12th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and we'll check in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now we'll look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Jeff, let's start with a story that follows up on one we talked about last week. This is about the siting for a power transmission cable from what will be the nation's first offshore wind farm. And the State Fisheries Agency has weighed in here now.
Right, and that's Vineyard Wind, Steve. And it's been in the news quite a bit lately as to where their 800-megawatt cable that will be coming from the wind farm southwest of the Vineyard is going to come ashore. There's a lot of talk about it going through Lewis Bay to West Yarmouth. And most recently, the company has signed a host agreement with the town of Barnstable for it to come ashore at Covell Beach in Centerville. And the Mass Division of Marine Fisheries came out this week with a report, actually a draft report, saying that Covell Beach is the preferred location as far as that's concerned, one of the locations. But it's not set in stone yet. It still needs to go in front of a siting board at the state, which has started work this week. We'll probably have a decision in April.
This letter, it contains, it said, the review's new information contained in an 1,100-page supplemental draft environmental impact report.
1,111 pages.
It's a very big report that they went through to come up with this decision.
It is.
And this is the initial filing here from Vineyard Wind was to bring the cable through Lewis Bay in West Yarmouth. So last week, the company came out and said that we've signed this host agreement now with Barnstable. We think we're going to bring it through Covell Bay.
That's right.
This is the state agency weighing in and saying, the fishery agency, and saying, we agree. We think it's a better spot.
Exactly. And they made their decision and their recommendation based on reliability, environmental impact, and cost. As we know, in West Yarmouth, the possibility of the cable coming ashore there has created a lot of controversy and unrest, especially amongst some of the shellfish fishermen in the Bay Area. They're saying it could impact their agriculture grants. There's a scallop area in Lewis Bay. And another thing that could be upset there is a mooring field. Also, it would have to cross this cable. It would have to cross a national grid cable to Nantucket.
I didn't know that until I read this here.
Nor did I. And they're talking about concrete mattresses would have to be put between them.
So a cable coming into Lewis Bay, a power transmission cable, would have to cross the power line that runs out to Nantucket, one of them.
Right.
And so they would have to lay these concrete mattresses to make that work, which is another reason in this letter here why it's maybe not the best preferred spot to come through into West Yarmouth.
That's right. And the shellfishermen obviously are happy with the way this is going right now. And they're saying, you know, for everyone involved, this is a better solution coming ashore in Centerville because sediment, which will be happening, a lot of sediment will be created with this. It dissipates much more quickly in open water as opposed to the bay.
Now, this is not finalized yet, as you say, and there are hearings going on up in Boston with the state's Environmental Facilities Siting Board, and they're going to be coming to a decision on this, but it's
next spring.
Going to be going on for a little bit.
It will.
In other offshore wind news, the company that built the first U.S. wind farm, which is 5 turbines off Block Island, it has big plans to expand, and an announcement out this week that it has been bought by a Danish company.
It has. This is a major acquisition in this industry. Ørsted is the Danish company, and they have bought Deepwater Wind for about $500 million. And what this will do when the two companies are combined, it will be the number one offshore wind platform in North America. And you may know Deepwater because they built the first offshore wind turbines in the United States, and that's off of Block Island.
They're a Rhode Island company.
Right, right. And that went online in 2016.
And they have 5 turbines off Block
they
Island.
Do.
So it's kind of a small version of what's to come. And now this Danish company wants to buy into the potential that the market has, see here on the East Coast.
Exactly, because there are other wind development projects in Connecticut, Maryland, New York, They're totaling about 810 megawatts of energy. And this will be a very large company. It's going to be called, by the way, Ørsted U.S. Offshore Wind.
Ørsted U.S. Offshore Wind. And, well, it implies the fact that this wind, offshore wind, is a huge market that's that these companies see is about to break wide open. And with Vineyard Wind happening south of the Vineyard, that's the first step in what they see is potential for wind turbines, as you say, all the way through Connecticut, Maryland, offshore New York, Virginia, up and down the East Coast.
That's right. And also with Deepwater having experience now with the wind farm off of Block Island, you know, even the National Wildlife Foundation has come out and endorsed this merger, saying that Deepwater has been very responsive and they do keep wildlife in mind when they are planning their developments.
So the world's largest offshore developer of offshore wind farms getting into the business right here on the East Coast. Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, let's talk about this a little bit. It's in its last full year of operation, and it has been losing money, a lot of it.
Yeah.
And this is mostly because of shutdowns related to equipment issues.
Yeah, that's right. They'll be winding down operations in the spring, by June 1st. But since January of this year, it has been shut down 57 days. And from the numbers that we have from Christine Legere, who is our reporter that follows Pilgrim quite closely, there's been a $63 million loss in gross revenue and about a $32 million lost in net revenue. And that's only going to get higher because there was another automatic shutdown Friday when a valve unexpectedly closed, causing a drop in reactor water level. And this has been happening quite a few times. It's not the first time we've seen the problem with these valves. And as of right now, according to a spokesperson from Entergy, the company that owns Pilgrim, there is no restart date right now. Maintenance is being done. And some of the numbers that Christine had in her story, I wasn't aware of it. It was kind of a surprise to me. But Pilgrim generates $1.1 million gross revenue per day and about $568,000 after all the bills are paid, as was put in the article. And that's when it's operating.
When it's running.
More.
So
when it's running.
It's down 63 days already this year, or 57 days already this year.
It's adding up.
It's adding up. The Pilgrim Watch advocates, people who are advocating for its shutdown and who are concerned about safety there, are pointing to this as one more indication that as the plant is getting ready to be decommissioned mid-year next year, that Pilgrim is not investing in it and is not the company Entergy is not investing in Pilgrim.
Yeah,
I think
they refer to some of this equipment as 1960s
technology. 1960s
technology.
Mm. Entergy saying, of course, that there's no problem there and that they are investing it in the plant to keep it running safely until the end. We're going to speak right now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, there's a proposal to replace a pair of old buildings on Main Street in Chatham that currently hold apartments and replace them with upscale condominiums. It's created a lot of interest and some strong feelings.
Yeah, definitely some strong feelings from some segments of the community here. Now, what we're talking about are two buildings towards the rear of property at 782 Main Street, which is between the lights at Crowell Road and the downtown Rotary. So it's right on the edge of downtown. The buildings are a bit run down, and they were characterized as moderately priced rental housing now. And, you know, they're not strictly affordable in the sense that they're technically counted as affordable housing, but the four apartments in these buildings are considered workforce housing, and critics say that they certainly won't be anywhere near affordable if town officials approve the property owner's plan to demolish them and replace them with three condo units and a three-car garage. Now, opponents of the project say that this is really sort of symbolic of what's been happening in Chatham and really throughout the Cape, as property values have increased in the last decade even, which has led to the moderately and low-cost rentals and single-family homes being replaced by higher-end housing. and what these are being called sort of luxury condos. Now, the owner of the property is Cape Associates, which is a development company, and their office is actually at the along the street on this property, with these apartment buildings to the rear. And they say they're going to basically replace what they say is kind of an eyesore right now with the more visually attractive buildings. And there'll still be three housing units of the four that are currently in those buildings available, they say. And going from four to three will lower the density on the property. Each of these are two-bedroom units. But critics have, along with questioning the way that the housing will be converted really from workforce to non-workforce housing, I guess you call it. Critics are also questioning whether the units are legal, and they cast doubt as to whether the Zoning Board of Appeals, which is currently looking at this proposal, can actually grant the variants and special permits that are being requested. In the most recent meeting on the project, however, Zoning Board members, while they held off on making any determination, looking for some guidance from Town Council on these legal issues, they were very clear that they said that they can't really address the affordability of the units. They say they have to look specifically at the criteria that's in the zoning bylaw, and that doesn't speak at all to affordability on the particular issues that they're looking at. Now, recently, the Board of Selectmen here established a task force to look at retaining young families in town. And some members of town boards, the selectmen have said, should really consider affordability when they're making these type of decisions. But zoning board members really rejected that that sort of proposition in this case, saying that they really couldn't do that. And if the town wants them to consider that, they need to change the zoning bylaw and add that to the criteria. And other people concurred. We talked with Dean Nicastro, chairman of Selectmen, and he said, yes, I agree this is a problem, but we need to change the zoning bylaw if we want this to be considered. So at this point, this project has made it through a couple of town boards, and they're still waiting for final approval from the planning board and the zoning board. And the zoning board has rescheduled the hearing for November 1st. So at that point, we'll find out what they've heard from town council about the legal issues. And selectmen in a couple weeks, actually in 2 weeks on the 22nd, are going to be looking at that task force issue and start looking at whether they should be asking town boards to include affordability in their decision making and whether that should be added as a criteria to the town's zoning bylaw.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. Jeff, the Steamship Authority unveiled a design for its new ferry terminal, and neighbors who turned out to the meeting were not happy with what they saw.
Yeah, that's right. This is part of a $60 million construction project right here in Woods Hole, Steve. It's a six-year project where they're going to reconstruct all the slips and the utilities at the ferry landing here, and then they're going to move to what they call the landside work. Part of that is a new terminal, ticket office, waiting room. And once again, it seems like it's been a tough year for the Steamship Authority, but they're mired in some controversy again.
Very big project, six-year, $60 million project, but the ferry, the building that they're talking about now is a new ticket building.
It is. And there was a public forum Tuesday night in Falmouth with the architects and Steamship Authority management to review the design for the new building. Didn't go over well. I don't know if anyone has had a chance to take a look at the schematics of it, but it is a two-story building, large two-story building, right where the current temporary office is. and it would block the views of the harbor from the Crane Street Bridge, which is when you're coming into Woods Hole and you look over and see the harbor. And that has been a big issue with some of the villagers here. They also claim that the design of the building, which is largely stone and glass, doesn't reflect the style of New England or the village here in Woods Hole. And one of the folks at the meeting described it as a ski lodge in Aspen. And there are also some recommendations that the Vineyard Haven and Hyannis steamship terminals, which aren't all that old, I would say within the last 15 years or so, are much more appropriate for
the design of those buildings.
They are.
It's perhaps a little more understated than what was suggested here.
Probably a bit smaller. And as far as the stone and glass components of the building, the architect says that those were chosen to withstand the salt air here in Woods Hole. So this, I don't think we've heard the end of this, but there is going to be an additional opportunity for people to provide comments because they weren't recorded at this meeting, and they've asked people to email them in.
I thought that was interesting. The Steamship Authority held a meeting to introduce this design to the public and to take comment, but they weren't recording the comments, and they said that people's input at that meeting was not going into the record.
It didn't seem like it was written down. It wasn't recorded. So when the question was asked about that, they said, well, you can certainly send some emails in with your concerns.
And some of the concerns here, again, about that blocking that view, but people wanting to know what was happening on the second floor of this building, why it required a second floor.
That's right.
When the ticket office, the temporary one they have now, is just a single
story. That's right. And they say, well, perhaps you can take the second floor off because it had this floor-to-ceiling, two-floor glass view of the harbor. And people are saying people waiting for the ferry really don't need that view because you're taking the view of Woods Hole away from Woods Hole. And they also suggested possibly turning the building around.
90 degrees switching,
exactly. But the issue with that was that it would disrupt the flow of traffic and the automobile loading zones and truck zones and bus zones.
And the Steamship Authority saying that they've looked at this carefully and they feel like this is the best design or this is where they're at right now, but they are taking more comment.
They are.
Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe held a rally and a march over the weekend. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this was last Saturday. And members of the tribe, as well as their supporters, non-tribal supporters and fellow townspeople, marched from Great Neck Road near Town Hall to the tribal headquarters, pretty much across town. From what I understand, there were about 150 to 200 people involved in the march. Reason this was held was to create some visibility for the tribe and their protest to a recent determination by the Department of the Interior that reversed a decision to place the tribe's properties, it's about 321 acres, here in Mashpee as well as up in Taunton, in trust. That happened on September 7th. Since then, a lawsuit has been filed to challenge the decision. Land remains owned by the tribe, Steve. But because it's not in trust, that means that the tribe can't have full control and jurisdiction over the land. Of course, that means that construction remains halted on the planned billion-dollar casino in Taunton.
And a lot of questions about whether if this land isn't in trust, whether the tribe is eligible for that casino in the same way it had been assumed it would be earlier.
Exactly. And, you know, just another issue the tribe is facing is they have a lot of opposition from some of the neighbors up there in Taunton that have been filing lawsuits, which was really part of how we got to the September 7th decision.
And this particular march and rally, it was also attended by members of other tribes from around the country, which was interesting. They were coming to show their support and feel like this decision really undermines some of the sovereignty issues for tribes across the country.
Exactly.
If it stands, if the decision stands.
Yeah, there's a big concern in Indian country about what's happening here.
We're going to speak right now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, special town meeting this week. Bring us up to speed on what happened.
Sure. We had a one-night special town meeting on Wednesday. It took just over 4 hours to complete. Big news, just two recreational marijuana dispensaries will be allowed on the island once the town's moratorium on recreational sales expires December 31st, following a vote Wednesday night. The 380 or so voters in attendance in the high school auditorium also enacted a single-use plastics ban and gave town meeting in the future more say in both private coastal erosion projects and the installation of private sewer lines beneath town streets. Unfortunately, though, there was a 452 voter quorum needed to vote on spending articles, and since that wasn't reached, proposals to spend about $12 million on Mid-Island road improvements, $21 million, most of which would be reimbursed by the FAA, for airport security and taxiway improvements, and $3 million in sewer work, didn't get voted on, so that's going to have to get pushed off to the future. Marijuana articles, they were overwhelmingly approved to limit to two. That followed a recommendation by the select board that the number of recreational marijuana licenses be limited to 20% of the year-round liquor licenses, and that's currently two. So once that moratorium expires, they'll be allowed to open primarily in the Mid-Island area. There are two zones already set up for that, and we already have one dispensary that's received all its state and local approvals for both medicinal and recreational marijuana, and they will get one of those licenses. It's not clear yet who might get the second one and what the criteria will be to issue that license. There's a couple of other dispensary proposals currently working their way through the local and state regulatory process.
Josh, Nantucket is taking notice of white sharks. What's happening here?
Well, most of the news, unfortunately, has been over on the Cape side, given the couple of attacks that happened at the end of the summer and early fall. But on Nantucket this year and this summer, there have been 25 shark-seal interactions, what marine mammal scientists are calling them, since May. Those are basically shark attacks on seals that have washed up on the shore. And there was a white shark sighting off the South Shore that closed beaches back in July. And in the weeks after the fatal white shark attack off Wellfleet in mid-September, some members of the Marine Mammal Alliance of Nantucket began meeting with Select Board Chairman Jason Bridges to talk about educating the public more about the potential for sharks off Nantucket's beaches and the unfortunate potential for shark attacks. And town officials are going to spend the next couple months as we head into next summer discussing how best to increase awareness, to provide public education about that. They're talking about increased signage. Select Board Member Bridges said he'll be speaking with town officials on the Cape who are already dealing with this about the most effective way to design the signs to put on island beaches warning of sharks' presence in the area. Nantucket already had a few signs on South Shore beaches and other beaches this summer, but they might have been designed too well because several of them were stolen and are probably, in the opinion of the harbor master, in dorm rooms or living rooms right now. The harbor master is also talking about increasing lifeguard training with regard to shark attacks. Lifeguards are being trained in first aid, including the use of trauma gauze and tourniquets, and she actually just had a conversation with some Cape officials last week about the potential installation of shark tracking buoys offshore that would give a little better real-time or close to real-time information about the potential for sharks being in the area off the island's South Shore. Now, all of this, primarily scientists believe, is due to the increase in the island waters of seals, gray seals and harbor seals in particular. Scott Leonard, who is the CEO of the Nantucket Marine Mammal Alliance, said that there are about 3,000 seals on Whale Shoal on Tuckernuck this year, and for the first time this year, they were on the south side of the island. That's not very common, and the south side of the island is very popular swimming, surfing, and recreational beaches, and that's where actually the sighting was this summer that closed the beaches for a day. So more seals, more sharks, more public awareness is needed, town officials say.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for checking in with us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. Jeff, the state has ordered National Grid to halt all natural gas pipeline work while it looks at safety issues, and this affects a major project going on in the Mid and Lower Cape.
It does, and this just comes after National Grid had some overpressurization of gas line, an issue in Woburn earlier this week. I think about 300 houses were affected. And, of course, a couple of weeks ago we had the major incident in Lawrence, but that was with Columbia Gas. And after this, Mass DPU told National Grid, you got to stop all the projects except for emergency projects to take a look to make sure everything's safe. Big effect here on the Cape. There is a $70 million gas line replacement project going on the Mid and Lower Cape. It's 18 miles of gas line replacement, which in 2004 was started to address an overpressurization problem that we had here. A spokesman from National Grid says right now there's no date for when this moratorium will be lifted, when work will restart. And when we talk about a moratorium, there's also been no hookups to National Grid gas lines since 2014 in Orleans, Harwich, Eastham, Brewster, Chatham, and Dennis. So we're coming up on 5 years of that. obviously a bit of a concern to the Chamber of Commerce and the business community. It's impacting the building and property management trades, new businesses starting up there. And it's a big concern, as Wendy Northcross of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce said.
And in no sense of when this is going to be, the work is going to be taken up again.
No, not at all, not as of this time. But it should be mentioned that the reason this came about in 2014 is because some of the service lines here on the Cape were found to be inadequate to handle the amount of gas going through them. So we may have dodged an issue such as they had up in Lawrence.
I want to take a moment to offer some congratulations. I'm not sure how well our listeners know this, but they are very well served by some great print journalists. New England Newspaper and Press Association gave out their awards this week, and the Cape region did very well. The Provincetown Banner named Newspaper of the Year in its circulation class. Martha's Vineyard Times also named Newspaper of the Year in its circulation class. Vineyard Gazette was a runner-up in its circulation class. And also, both the daily and Sunday editions of the Cape Cod Times were named Distinguished Newspapers for 2018 in their categories. And the Cape Cod Times reporters Doug Frazier and Marianne Bragg won an award for their reporting on the North Atlantic right whale. So congratulations to all, and really a thank you for the service that you provide our communities. And thanks to these papers for joining us regularly here on the News Roundup. I want to bring on right now Casey Myers of the Provincetown Banner. Casey, good morning, and congratulations on the award.
Thank you very much, Steve. And how you doing, Jeff?
Doing well. How are you?
Good.
Casey, in Provincetown, there's a proposal to build a funicular, a kind of cable car, to go up the hill to the Pilgrim Monument. We've talked about it a bit in the past when it was first floated, but now the idea seems to be moving forward. Bring us up to date.
Okay, yes. So for people who don't know, because I know I had to look up the word when I first heard about it, a funicular is sort of a tram. It's a cross between a glass elevator and a small railroad car that runs on a narrow track, usually up steep hills. The closest one to the Cape is in Plymouth, and it's used to take the members of the White Cliffs Country Club to the beach, down up and down these steep cliffs. And in Provincetown, as everybody knows, there's the Pilgrim Monument, which is at the top of an 80-foot-tall hill called High Pole Hill. And what the owners of the monument, the Cape Cod Pilgrim Memorial Association, have proposed to do is construct a funicular that will run from behind Town Hall at the Barreleaf Park. It will run up 80 feet to the campus of the Pilgrim Monument. And it's like everything in Provincetown, it's been a little bit controversial because downtown Provincetown is so densely constructed, and neighbors are very worried about the added noise, and some neighbors are literally a few feet away from this proposed project. So anyway, the funicular is just so fascinating. It's kind of to me like the Pilgrim Monument. It's just this very different type of architecture that's being proposed in Provincetown. It's made its way through all the regulatory boards, and now it's at the end of the line, coming up before the planning board on October 25th for its final approvals. It will be able to carry up to 18 people in a 2 to 3 minute ride, and during its peak traffic times in the summer, it will be estimated to bring about 180 to 200 passengers per hour up and down the Monument Hill, High Pole Hill. So as I said, some abutters are very worried about the change it'll bring, both in terms of traffic and noise, and also in terms of just how it'll change the face of Provincetown. But it also has tremendous support in the list of letters. According to the attorney for the Pilgrim Memorial Association, there was 121 letters in favor that have gone before regulatory boards versus 52 letters opposed to the project. So we'll see what happens on October 25th. I'm not sure that the planning board will make a decision at that point or just listen to more of the material, but we'll see.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thanks for bringing us up to speed on that.
Yeah, and I can vouch for Casey. I was sitting next to her when we looked up the word funicular. She was no idea what it was.
But you let her define it. Right?
That's right.
Casey, thanks again.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, the town of Brewster has been dealing with issues of financial management. We've talked about them quite a bit on the News Roundup over the past couple of months. Now Brewster's finance director is pushing back. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is something that's been in the news, as you mentioned, Steve, since earlier this summer when the town management in Brewster realized that there may have been some issues, and about a $37 million discrepancy involving some overspending, misuse of town money without town manager approval, et cetera. The Brewster finance director at the time, a woman named Irene Larrivee, was accused of making the errors. She was on an extended medical leave and is now on an administrative leave. And as you may expect, she's lawyered up. And her attorney last week issued a statement, put out a letter to the town saying that this was a witch hunt and a crusade against Ms. Larrivee. She said, in fact, it was the town that had the issues and that she actually was one that brought it to the town's attention. Town fired back, as you know, they typically don't talk about personnel issues or personnel matters, but this time they did. They called the letter self-serving. They also had a hearing on Larrivee's job performance this week. Appears as if she was there but did not provide a verbal response, but did give a written statement, which hasn't been released yet. And in fact, the attorney said that since she uncovered these issues, the town should actually be thanking her.
The attorney for Larrivee.
Yes.
So we have not heard the last in that story there.
No. It's like it's heading to the court.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Jeff Spillane. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. And with us on the phone right now is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, congratulations to the Martha's Vineyard Times for your award from the New England Newspaper and Press Association.
Hey, thanks a lot, Steve, and good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, George.
Hey, I wanted to say, Steve, sitting at the award ceremony yesterday, I was struck by you really know how to pick them. You know, you have a great collection of newspapers talking to you each week, and Martha's Vineyard is particularly lucky to have both the Martha's Vineyard Times and the Vineyard Gazette. So,
yeah, our listeners are really well served by great print journalism in this region, and there's a long tradition of it, and it continues. So, we're very lucky that way. George, you've got a story about one citizen who's taken it upon himself to stripe a road in Vineyard Haven and the response by the state. Tell us what's happening here.
Yeah, so this is Frank Brunel, and he is a Beach Road resident. He has been opposed to what's known as a shared use path for pedestrians and bicycles that the state wants to put in along this road. They want to try to connect Oak Bluffs and Vineyard Haven so that bicycles are really big over here, you know, to be able to make that ride safely. And so there's been a project. It's in the final design stages. And he and some other people along Beach Road object to it, mostly because of the land taking that would be involved. He in particular feels like it would be more dangerous than just having a symmetrical road where there would be a fog line put in and where the bikes could stay and also a sidewalk for pedestrians. And so he took matters into his own hands, put out duct tape on the road where he measured 5 feet for where the fog line should be. And the state said, yeah, that's a no-no. You're not allowed to put anything within the roadway. Jeff might remember this. I think it happened over in Falmouth as well. Someone took matters into their own hands. And, yeah, it's a big no-no to do that and potentially dangerous because, you know, people were following these markings in the road wondering, you know, what they were and whether the state had put them in.
George, a fog line is – can you explain that?
Yeah, so a fog line is put on along the side of a road, like the shoulder of a road, and it's meant it's a way for motorists, especially at night, to be able to see the side of a road so that they don't veer off of it. You know, there are center lines as well, but that's picked up. The fog line is picked up by your headlights and reflects back, and so you can see where you know that you're not going off the road.
So the state said that this isn't allowed, and they pulled up the tape. What's the response been?
So they pulled up the tape, and you know, Frank is saying to people, "Look, this was a good experiment. It showed that the symmetrical road will work, and you know, it remains to be seen how this project is going to work its way out. We have three members of the Board of Selectmen in Tisbury, and they all have different opinions on this. One is staunchly in favor of the shared use path. One is opposed to it, and there's a third member who hasn't made his mind up yet. So it's going to be interesting. So you know, Frank is trying to gather some evidence to sway that third vote in his favor.
George, you have another story I want to talk about briefly here. The island's only approved medical marijuana dispensary is aiming to be cultivating a crop by early December. Brittany Bowker, your reporter, went out and took a look at this setup and really gives us a sense of where the process is.
Yeah, so she went out and took a look at it. And, you know, this is probably the only time we're going to be able to get inside. Jeff Rose, who's putting this together, told us that once the dispensary is in place, due to Massachusetts law, the actual cultivation area and the dispensary itself will be off limits to tours and things like that. So it was a good glimpse behind the scenes before things get ratcheted up. But this has been a long time coming. People have been waiting for it. And he's hopeful, as you said, to be cultivating by December and then, you know, get it up and running in the new year. For people who need this for medical purposes, you know, this is a big step for them.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Yes, thank you, Steve. Take care.
Okay. Jeff Spillane is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, towns across the region are looking for ways to improve attendance at town meeting. We heard Josh Balling speaking about town meeting attendance on the island, saying that they didn't have enough to make a quorum to make decisions on financial matters. You have a nice article in the Cape Cod Times looking at ways that towns have been dealing with this issue.
Yeah, we do. And, you know, town meeting season is upon us. And when Josh mentioned that there are, I believe, 480 attendees.
He said there were 350 and they needed something like 480.
That's impressive compared to some of the town meetings I've been to. Town meeting season is upon us. I know in Mashpee, where I live, it is coming up on Monday. And many of them are just not well attended. So a very, very small percentage of the population, some as low as 1%, Steve, have been making decisions for entire towns here on the Cape and Islands.
And towns have been struggling with this for a while and trying to figure out ways to encourage people out.
Yeah, this is nothing new. They're trying to figure out how to get people there, even just to get a quorum. And Ethan Yenter, who wrote the article for us, said that Bourne has even decreased their quorum from 250 to 125 people. And even then, back in 2015, they had to go it's in the auditorium of the high school, they had to go into the gym and get parents from a youth basketball game to come in and get to a quorum. Some towns are saying perhaps we can move it to a Saturday. Maybe we'll get some more people there because some of the older people can't drive and families with children have things going on at night. But, you know, people have plans on weekends too. Mm-hmm. So other options that towns are looking at, I don't think they want to go there, is to perhaps move to a town council type of government like Barnstable has, and or a representative town meeting like Falmouth has, which is a very interesting story that Ethan uncovered as to how that happened. It was right here in Woods Hole back in the 1930s. A lot of neighbors were very upset about someone trying to, I guess,
ice out of one of the ponds.
Yeah, that's right. And so 300 people from Woods Hole took a train into Falmouth. And I guess at that point they decided there were too many people, so we might as well have representatives interesting story. Never heard
so
that before.
They were kind of trying to pack the room to make decisions, right? And so now they've decided to have a representative town government. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know, and that still happens as far as packing the room. But if there's a hot button issue in some of these towns, I mean, I've seen it happen where you usually get 100 people at a town meeting, you get several hundred. Ways to draw people in.
Funny ways that towns have tried now to get people out, right?
Food trucks. We'll have babysitting for you in Wellfleet. If you stay till the end, you can be part of a drawing for beach stickers. You know, this has been a problem for a while.
Some local arts groups have got some much-welcomed grant funding. It's an unusual grant, it sounds like.
It is. This is an organization, the Bar Clayman Family Arts Initiative. It's based in Boston. It's been a lengthy application process, but 29 organizations here in Massachusetts have been chosen. And what they were looking for were organizations that were taking risks but doing it intelligently. I thought that was a great great parameter. And three organizations here did receive money. $312,000 went to the Payment Performing Arts Center in North Truro. That's their largest ever grant.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe they're looking at a new tent for next summer. And $387,000 to the Provincetown Art Association and Museum.
Mm-hmm.
The other recipient here on the Cape and Islands was the Featherstone Center for the Arts in Oak Bluffs. But the amount of their grant was not available as of yet. And these are over the course of 3 years, these grants.
And then there's an opportunity, it sounds like, for these grants to be renewed for another 3 years. So
That's right. Looking
at potentially a double amount over twice as long, which is really a shot of good news for these nonprofits in the area.
It is.
Groups.
And some of them are saying, like, this, we've never seen anything like this.
Jeff, there was a boat accident in Buzzards Bay on Monday night. It threw five people into the water. They were all rescued. It's quite a story.
Yeah, it sounds horrible, Steve. This happened on Monday, which, of course, was a holiday for a lot of people. A boat, a 23-foot boat, happened to be owned by the fire chief in Mattapoisett, a gentleman named Andrew Murray, hit a buoy in the Hog Island Channel right at the Cape Cod Canal. And it is. It's been called miraculous that some of these rescues were successful and nobody died. There were some minor injuries. But the chief and four of his passengers were thrown in the water. And folks on shore started hearing screaming. When first responders arrived, there were two people struggling in the water. They were rescued. And three more were found clinging to a channel marker. And what makes this such an amazing story is, first of all, it was October. It was 8 o'clock. It was dark. It was these people were 120 feet out.
Mm.
And if you know the canal area, there's a strong current there. So I guess miraculous is kind of appropriate here. And the boat, after it had hit the buoy, continued to operate unmanned.
Mm.
It was eventually corralled.
And it was a police officer who jumped into the water and saved two of the people who were in the water.
Yeah, I believe it's the Wareham Police Department and the Onset Fire Department who are the real heroes in this one.
Hmm. Jeff, there's a tidal testing site along the Cape Cod Canal. Your reporter Beth Terfizian takes a look at it in an article this week. It's a testing site for new technology.
Yeah, and just having talked, it's appropriate. We just talked about the current right there at the canal. This is it's a platform right by the railroad bridge, and it's operated by the Marine Renewable Energy Collaborative, and it was installed about a year ago, and it allows users to develop and test underwater turbines and sensors. It's up and running now. It's been very successful. Companies and universities are collecting water temperature data, movement of currents, and meteorological data. The next challenge for this test site is to get it online, connecting the platform to something other than battery power so that these researchers can remotely access the data and to collect the data for longer periods. Right now it has to be done in person one time a week or one time a month. This organization recently received a little over $200,000 in the state's economic development bill. The money hasn't been released yet, but they're hoping that it will allow them to get everything online.
And when it's fully up and running, it's going to be one of the only tidal turbine test sites, well, the only one in the United States, it sounds like.
It is. It is. Right now, the only others are in Scotland, Canada, and France. and it appears as if this is something that is really in demand here in the U.S. So this will be a big plus, because it will be an affordable way to scale up testing for real-world applications for developers here in the States.
Now, Barnstable County will accept the bid for a use of a property. You reported this story. The bid itself is not for much money at all, which is part of the story. And I guess another part of the story is why it is.
Yeah, Barnstable County has a farm. It's a 96-acre farm off of Route 6A. Up until about 10 years ago, it was operated by the Sheriff's Department. And so the county leased it out for no rent for the past 10 years. And the current leaseholder, his name is Tim Friary, who currently operates the Cape Cod Organic Farm there, was the winning bidder. In fact, he was the only bidder for the farm property. And he bid $625 a year for the next 3 years for 16.3 acres, four greenhouses, a farm stand, an office, and storage. It may sound like a very small amount of money. In fact, I think
you
compared
it
to an iPhone. And one of the,
it's like an iPhone a year or a lesser model, yes.
Yeah, not the top model either. But the average for leasing agricultural property in Massachusetts is right around $30 an acre. So it was a fair value. And prior to this bid and this lease, which still needs to be signed, the Cape Cod Organic Farm had the entire use of the property. But it's a much smaller piece now because the county wants to retain some acreage there. They want to expand the Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, possibly have an educational facility, from what I understand, trying to teach kids where food comes from, and maybe have one of those setups where farming occurs under solar panels.
Mm.
So going to be a lot of happening out there at that property.
And Friary, who's been leasing this property, as you say, with no rent, but he did a lot of improvements.
Oh, he did. He so did. Much. And, you know, thanks for mentioning that. That was part of the original lease. He has put $22,000 into it and also received about $180,000 in grants for everything from building new chicken coops to improving the soil and the ecosystem there.
Jeff Spillane, you are the political beat reporter for the Cape Cod Times.
Yes.
As we get near the end of the program, I want to take a few minutes to ask you about the political scene and what we're seeing. Let's start with tomorrow.
Sure. Tomorrow, the Cape Cod Times, in partnership with the League of Women Voters of the Cape Cod area, we will be having a candidates forum. It's going to be held at the Cape Cinema in Dennis. And there will be two races that we'll be focusing on. At 10 o'clock, the candidates for Cape and Islands State Senate, that's Senator Julian Sear, the incumbent, and his Republican challenger, John Flores, who is a Barnstable Town Councilor. They will be, I guess we can use the word debating, from 10 to about 10:45. At 11 o'clock, Congressman Bill Keating, looking for his, I believe, fifth term on Capitol Hill, will be challenged by his opponent, who is a Republican from Marshfield, named Peter Tedeschi, familiar name to a lot of people up there in that area. So they will be starting at 11 o'clock, going to right about noon.
And you will be moderating that.
I'll be one of them, yes.
And looking at some other political notes from the week, we saw the Democratic and Republican candidates for governor squaring off and debate.
They did. That was Tuesday night, and it was televised live. And something very interesting in today's column that we have. If you had watched that, you could see Governor Baker definitely had a significant height advantage over his opponent, Jay Gonzalez.
Baker's just a tall guy.
He's just a tall guy. And one thing that we had picked up on is the Cape Cod Republican Club did kind of take a swipe at him for that. And said that the governor was head and shoulders over Jay Gonzalez. And one other thing I'd like to get in there from this week's political notes is October 17th. If you're not registered to vote, you have to register to vote by Wednesday. And a lot of town halls are going to be open late on that day.
So the election is 26 days
away. 26 days from today. And, of course, early voting starts on the 22nd.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And I want to thank Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. We checked in with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.